I believe that most of us who have been trying to practice any spiritual tradition will have these moments where we feel that we're being called to level up, right? We're being mm-hmm. called to step beyond what our comfort zone to a new level of resonance. And these last few years have definitely been that for me, especially the last year or two. And I think it's really important that we reanimate our own spiritual lives with our heart, that we take it as our own,
yeah.
you know, and that there's no way that anyone else can live your tradition for you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Fear Radical podcast today. I had a great fortune of meeting a dear friend, a world-renowned musician, artist, storyteller, Gauravani. Gauravani spent his childhood in temples in India, training to be a monk. He spent his teenage years in Hollywood, learning to play rock and roll. His music brings these two influences together into a celebration of story and song, dance and rhythm. He thrills audiences, carrying them to the worlds of legend, of curiosity, and inspiration. Traveling the globe for 20 years, Gauravani has witnessed the power of music to transcend ethnicity, nationality, and religion. Building community where he goes, he inspires whoever he meets towards the highest cultivation of the human spirit. And I must say, you, dear friends, this bio is true. That has been my experience in today's conversation. It was a very moving, touching, like-minded, kindred-spirited sharing where we explored so many topics about from death to illness to liminal space to existential crisis to renewing our membership to our tradition on a daily basis to fear, to love, to friendship, to poetry, and through everything in between that you can possibly imagine, and even more than that. So it was a true blessing to be sitting at the table with a dear brother. So you're welcome to sit with us. This is the Free Radical Podcast. And to support it, of course, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel supported, nourished, held by the conversation, feel free to like it, share it, and drop your comments to keep the conversation ongoing, dynamic, ever-evolving. That's what we're all trying to do here, to keep engaged in this dialogue with reality that has never begun, will never end. Without further ado, brothers, sisters, friends, family, here is Gauravani. Gauravani Prabhu, welcome. Thanks for coming to the Free Radical Podcast.
Thank you. I am feeling radical and I'm feeling free, Maharaj. Thank you for inviting
me. Okay, those are the two most important conditions. And I always like to clarify, because I know the word radical may make some people a little nervous. It sounds radical. You're about to burn down buildings. But radical just means something that goes to the root, right? In Latin means radix. So like the exploration in trying to go to the roots of things, to the core of things. And free radical, which means in a way that makes us free, right? With the purpose of bringing more freedom in our exploration. So
wow. So is it connected to the word radish, like the root? Maybe radish is also
I never explored that one, but it makes total sense. Yeah, because the original Latin is radix with X.
Uh-huh.
So no wonder that radish, yeah, it's something that...
A root vegetable.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know that the roots, you know, one of the songs that I love to sing is a song by Guru Nanak about how all of the traditions have bhakti underneath them, like a river that's feeding. So they're all taking the nourishment from below, you know. So radical is even going down to get to the river underneath everything that's supporting everything and everyone.
The undercurrent, like the silver line weaving in between everything. Yes. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, I was thinking about the mycelium, this like mushroom,
right,
fungi interconnectedness network that is like everywhere, basically.
Right.
But it's beyond our normal way of seeing things. We just need to dig a little bit, right? Unearth a little bit, and it's
and
there.
And it's connecting the whole forest, and every little murmur is being heard and listened to by the whole divine entity.
Yeah. That's always a thought that I bring to my mind when I'm walking. I'm here in nature now, and I love to be nature. And when I'm going out for a walk, I try to remind myself, okay, already looking at nature as I can look it below the surface, it's beautiful, but there's so much going on down, right?
Right.
So important to do that descending work and exploring the roots of things as well.
It's so true. I heard, I'm not a scientist, I don't know so much about, you know, physics and science, but I heard some time ago that most matter is dark matter that we don't perceive. Like, it's not even really perceivable in you know, with normal senses. And I like that Krishna is dark, and the Shyam, that the rain cloud of mercy, that dark matter is actually the fabric of all existence, is in this invisible and imperceivable state, but it's holding everything together.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, one name of Krishna is Ghanashyam, which is like the dark cloud. And right. Christian mystics have this book, very nice book by an anonymous author called The Cloud of Unknowing, which for me is related to this idea of something, okay, most of matter is dark and we cannot perceive it. And okay, Krishna is that darkness behind everything, that dark cloud. And even what we have perceived so far about Krishna still is just one point of an infinite ocean, right? So
right. There's that. I love one of the things I learned from my mother, Rukmini, is how to see the similarities in different traditions. And I don't know if you've ever had her on your podcast, but I would love to help her meet you one day
please,
on the
please.
Podcast. But
I need your bridging there.
Yes. She always encourages that every tradition has these, you know, meditations. And one of the ones from Islam that I love is the idea that if you had an ocean of ink and you described all of the qualities known of God, that the ocean would run dry and you would even need another ocean to describe all of the qualities.
Yeah, that's something I really appreciate about you, Guru Banerjee, which is, I remember, because I always like to start my podcast also sharing briefly how I met my guests for the first time, or how I came to know about them if I never met them yet in 3D. I met you in 3D twice, actually. We briefly crossed paths in Washington, D.C. last year.
Right.
It was a nice moment, and we shared
a quick snack of prasad. It was just a moment.
Yeah, and there was a very nice Vaishnavi who I think she sang in your one of your albums.
That's right. Yeah, Shrivani. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, she's just a housewife from Washington, but she has the voice of an angel, of a you know, Chakora bird or whatever.
And suddenly in between snacks, you invited her to bring some offering, and she was doing this angelic kirtan. And it's like, okay, this is what it means to meet Gauravani for 5 minutes. Good adventure.
Well, I do feel that I'm incredibly wealthy, not financially by Krishna's infinite wisdom, but in friends, I'm certainly phenomenally wealthy. My son was we were having breakfast, and my son was saying, how do you know so many people? I know so many amazing people, actually.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because, again, not wanting to make absolute parallels between to people's life, but I can say in many ways something similar, and in a very humbling way, right?
Yeah.
Because I invite many people and guests to my podcast, which eventually all of them, I consider them my friends and brothers and sisters, and from different traditions and backgrounds, and many of them is like, Maharaj, how can you know that people? How do you get to know them? And you seem to, and as you say, I'm wealthy in terms of friendship. I really appreciate that. That way of conceiving wealth, right? Because
if we
limit wealth to what's in my pocket or bank account,
yeah, I can show you what's in my. I still have some rupees from when I came back from India. That's what
I have. Yeah. And then after that, those 5-10 minute meeting in DC, I was looking for, okay, 5 minutes with Gauravani in DC is this. I want the extended version, and I had it a few months ago in Germany. We were in the Bhakti Bloom, and
it was lovely.
We had more time to share. You even made the Swami dance, so congratulations for that feat.
I got to also listen to your beautiful lecture and your elegant way of presenting the essential elements of Krishna consciousness and bhakti and you know, in a way that's so accessible and mm-hmm. universal and inviting. And I really appreciate that so much.
Thank you. Thank you. And I really appreciate that. I remember during that lecture that I think it was on self-love in the context of God's unconditional love. And at one point you couldn't contain and you raised your hand.
I'm so sorry.
You had a question and it was great. But then your raised hand created a domino effect that other raised hands. And it was great. It was whatever it needed to be. But then after the lecture, you sent me a message like, apologizing, sorry, Maharaj, I couldn't contain. I was like, no, that's that's how it should happen.
Yeah, each teacher has their own, you know, culture around how best to teach for their style. For example, my mother, she likes to write down her thoughts, and she goes linearly through the thoughts because it creates a... And I'm more like, you know, grabbing things here and there and a little bit, you know, pastiche of ideas. But yeah, but it was lovely. And I think everyone in that room was deepened and left with a more intimate understanding of themselves and also of how the path of bhakti can be applied in a practical way. So it was lovely. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah. And again, I'm not a flatterer, to be honest. And so, but naturally I felt that we were, I remember even before the lecture, you were doing some kirtan, and in between you quoted some poem by Rumi, and I was like, okay, I like this guy. And I was just happening to be reading a book with poems by Rumi and other authors, and I gave you the book, and we're back and forth. Yeah, yes. Yeah, I like to do this. Yeah.
The art of translation, I think, is so important. You know, one of the first questions that I asked my teacher, Radhana Swami, is why, if Krishna is universal, why does he seem so Indian? Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, why is everything so Indian around Krishna and bhakti and all this stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
And of course, you know, any time that the divine, you know, pierces through into this world, wherever that place is that the divine appears is going to feel Muslim or Hindu or Christian, you know, like, mm-hmm. why is Jesus so Christian? Well, the whole thing came because he brought this energy, and with him, this whole culture developed. Right. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love the art of translation because I find that, you know, the fingerprints of the translator end up enriching. It's like in our own tradition, this idea of sukha, the parrot who tastes uh-huh. the fruit, and the fruit becomes more sweet than it was. It ripens.
Uh-huh.
And so I think a translator can either hinder or help in that process of that sweetening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like in that case to think about two types of parrot going to the sukha analogy. One parrot can just parrot.
Right.
Parrot this whole thing, like copy paste without any
repetition. Yeah.
Without any added sweetness to the thing. And then there is the parrot we want to be, which is bringing it to another level, so to say, right?
And a messenger, you know, in Vrindavan, the parrots are the messengers of Radha and Krishna.
Uh-huh.
So they carry those messages. So it's, you know, they're bringing that sweetness and the beauty. I mean, you've seen these beautiful green with the, you know, orange or red necked, you know, little necklaces. They bring so much beauty, and they're bringing messages of love. And I love it. Yeah, we want to be the sweet parrot.
That can be a title for today's podcast, How to Become a Parrot. The sweet parrot.
The sweet parrots. Yeah.
Okay, so far we are talking about unconditional love and parrots and dancing and so many things. And that's very proper of you, because I remember when we already agreed for this podcast, and I asked you, do you prefer to explore any particular topics? And you say, I'm happy to discuss anything. And we're already doing that. You say politics, religion, money, and death.
Yes, all the forbidden topics. We should touch on all of them today, if possible.
Taboo conversations. Okay,
taboo.
Let's Let's invoke taboo. Yeah, but you saying politics, money, death. I for me, it felt also like anything that lies in between all that as well, which is basically anything and everything.
I was just mentioning to my son how mysterious life is, and this will come up, I know, at some point, but I just had to do a complete reset on my life out of the blue a week ago and return to America. I had so many plans in India. I had been working since last year, and a health crisis came up. I ended up in the ICU for a week in two Mumbai hospitals, and basically was able to just get healthy enough to fly home and then continue now treatment here at home. So I was just telling my son how life is so fascinating, that if you ignore everyone else's perspective on what success is, you will never be successful. If you completely ignore it, you know, especially in the material world, in the world of life, if you just completely ignore whatever everyone says, no one will ever consider you a success. Very rarely, you know.
Yeah.
But if you do what everyone tells you to, you will also not be successful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating, this, and this reminds me of, like, really, this liminal space is my favorite space to be in, the space between things. The space where the spiritual and the material world connect. I've always joked that if I could have a podcast that I ran, it would be about the connection between the realms, the connection between where the spiritual realm, you can follow some dots and then it disappears. And the material realm, you can see, and then where do they meet? You know? And they do, of course, meet in politics and in money and in everything, in everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I really appreciate your your input, because, again, I mean, I'm, in one sense, I'm getting to know you more. And for me, yes, podcasts are a chance of continuing developing my friendships and connections with people.
Yes, it's true.
But I totally relate to what you are saying. I personally am totally passionate about the in-betweens and the connecting points and seeing everything also like integrated and not necessarily compartmentalizing reality. Okay,
right.
The spiritual goes here, the material goes here, it has nothing to do with one another, but how they dance together, how they meet, because at the end of the day, I mean, the divine is everywhere. Now Krishna is omnipresent. So like the other day I was seeing a video, it was very interesting in Spanish, but there was a guy asking a person in the street, he came with a big bunch of money, and he said, I give you all this money if you tell me where God is. And the guy said, I'll give you the double of this money if you tell me where God is not.
Ah, nice answer.
He's everywhere, my friend.
Yes,
said,
yes.
Like that.
It's like Prahlad. It's Prahlad telling his father.
That's what I thought. Someone shared with me that video and I commented Prahlad.
Exactly.
Right?
Except Prahlad wasn't risking money. Prahlad was risking his very life in that response.
Many times.
Yeah,
many times.
Yeah.
But he will say, where is he not? I'm finding him everywhere.
Where is he not?
Literally.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Please go on with that podcast. I think it will be very interesting experience to get into the.
There's a story that my mom taught me that I love to tell about a king who was very proud, and he had a guru, and the guru was always trying to manage this king. And you know how kings are, like, very prideful sometimes. And, you know, traditionally, you know, if they don't like your answer, you know, off with your head, you know, kill this guy. I don't like what he said. So he one day says to the guru, I have a question for you. You come into my palace. I have a question for you. So the guru makes the pilgrimage in and meets the king, and the king's on his high throne, sitting above the whole court filled with people. And he says, I am busy every day. So busy taking care of my kingdom. What does God do every day? You tell me, how is he so busy? What is he doing? I want to know the details. And the guru goes home and he thinks he doesn't want to know the answer to this question. He's just trying to, like, you know, trick me. So the guru starts packing up his house to go to another kingdom. He's going to leave. He's like, I don't want to lose my head over
Save
this.
His head, know. Yeah.
And he has a young disciple who's like a farmer who comes and says, Guru Maharaj, where are you going? And he says, he tells him the whole story. And the farmer says, but I've learned from you the answer to this question already. Let me go in your place and give the answer to the king. So he goes and he walks and he's dirty and he's, you know, and he goes to the palace and they're like, you know, who are you, peasant? And, you know, he tells them, I've come on behalf of my guru to answer the question. They let him in and there he is, surrounded by viziers, and there high on the throne is a king. And he says, what is the answer? And the poor farmer says, Your Majesty, to answer, you need to come down from the throne. I can't answer with you there.
Uh-huh.
And the whole, you know, oh my God, what are they telling this man? And then he says, no, he comes down, you know, lifts his coats and comes down and he's there. And he says, so what is your answer? He's standing right next to the farmer. What is your answer? And the farmer says, but Your Majesty, you see, to answer, I have to be sitting there on the throne. Everyone's losing. Like, how can he do this? You know, king famous for taking people's heads.
Uh-huh.
So the farmer climbs up on top of the throne and he sits down on the king's throne and he says, this is what God does every day. He uplifts those who are meek and he humbles those who are proud.
Wow. Amen.
Maybe this is why I'm being humbled with my health.
Thank you, Rukminiji, for sharing that story with Gauravani and Gauravani with us. Beautiful. Yeah, we can take so much from that in our particular tradition about Krishna himself feels happy to humble himself in front of his devotees, and so many verses that come to my mind, him saying, I'm just following after the footsteps of my devotees,
right.
I'm bathed by the foot dust of their feet,
right.
Trying to be purified. Jiva Goswami said, trying to be purified by my fault of not being able to properly reciprocate for their love to me. It's like, wow, that's too much.
This is Krishna. I think, you know, I think that this is something that the world would benefit from understanding. It's not that those devotees of Krishna say that Krishna is better than their God or better than their religion, but he is inviting you into this level of sweetness that may not be apparent at the first reading of your own tradition.
Mm.
It's not that it's not there. Mm-hmm. The mystics all are excavating in all these traditions, but in many ways it's hidden. And, you know, hidden things are usually because they're precious. They're so precious. Yeah, well, so you hide them so that they're not easily stolen.
Again, you have to go to the root. Again, we have to unearth a little bit.
To become radishes.
I have that experience. Yeah, longing. Yeah, tratra laulyam apikalam mulyam. I have that experience in my podcast, inviting people from Christian background, Sufi background, Jewish background, that they are good excavators and they got to that place of God as sweetness and intimacy. And we feel, okay, we are on the same page, speaking the same language. And sometimes you can be talking with someone from your own tradition who is not doing their excavation homework.
That's true.
And we may feel, okay, we are in a different planetary system here, without criticizing, condemning, just...
Well, no, I mean, if we want to dive into a subject that's heavy on my heart right now, this resistance inside Prabhupada's movement to allow qualified women to give initiation.
Okay, taboo topics number one, Gauravani uncensored, take one.
It's just, you know, Pandita Samadarshana, Bhagavad Gita 101, it's so simple. And if you read the conversation between Ramananda Roy and Lord Chaitanya, nowhere in there is he discussing someone's gender for the qualification of being a spiritual master. No. It's not.
In fact, he says, kibabi prakibanyasi sudrake ninai, etc., right?
In fact, some may criticize Prabhupada to say that Prabhupada was overly concerned with Varnashram because Lord Chaitanya abandoned Varnashram. He's like, forget all these things. And all that matters is trying to take the association, take the holy name, give it to everyone. So the idea that we're willing to do anything to discourage someone based on their gender and stop the flow of mercy for people who may be better suited to have an intimate relationship with a female guru because of their body or their proclivity is just so ridiculous and so foolish to me, you know? And moving backward into what you were talking about, I think as a young person who grew up in the movement, I took for granted everything, that it was just the way that it is. But Prabhupada's mercy, Bhaktisiddhanta's mercy, the mercy of Ishwarapuri and Lord Chaitanya and our whole sampradaya, to break whatever is required to make sure that the mercy is delivered, that piece of it, I think I'm recognizing as one of the shining gems of our tradition, not, you know, so rather than being rigid, you know, one of my godbrothers, a senior disciple of Radhana Swami, said there's always the orthodoxy and the avant-garde, and they have a relationship. It's not that they're against each other.
Yep.
The orthodoxy wants to stay rooted because that's their service, and the avant-garde wants to push the boundaries. And that tension creates that beautiful bowstring where you can shoot those arrows for great distance, you know.
And hit the actual aim that we are supposed to hit.
And hit the target, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking how Christian mystics, in particular a friend of mine and a mentor, Father Richard Rohr, he will use terminology of priests and prophets regarding orthodoxy and avant-garde, like those who are there to keep the order and the structure and the statu quo, which is great, and those who need to challenge those things in a healthy way,
right,
not for the sake of disturbing
or
anarchy,
yes,
but just keeping the thing relatable, relevant, growing, not stagnant, not complacent. And the two of them should be, again, not enemies with one another, but learning to coexist with together. And but again, he will say we needed a seminar of, like a seminary for prophets, like our tradition, he will say for Christianity, but we can extend that to any tradition, should train prophets. And by prophets, he means people who are willing to speak the truth, basically, you know, to represent God. And yeah, I totally agree. Since you brought that to the table, last week, I mean, at least from the time we are recording this podcast, February 13, last week I recorded a video on this situation in ISKCON. And it was funny because, of course, I've never been institutionally affiliated with ISKCON myself, but I've always been connected with Prabhupada because my former gurus were Prabhupada disciples, and I'm also especially connected with Srila Siddhar Maharaj, which was so close to Prabhupada. So
sure, very close.
For me, ISKCON is not, it cannot be reduced just to the institutional side of it. There is so much
without
more.
Prabhupada, there is no ISKCON. You can't take for, you know,
exactly. And it was funny because some people commented, like, after hearing my, immediately I clarified, I'm not officially a member of ISKCON. I said, after hearing that, I stopped listening. It's like, well, going back to what you say, sometimes if we are not open to receive feedback, even if you want to consider me an outsider, okay, but we should be able to gain input from outsiders as well.
Of course. I think recently, so this has been quite an interesting time. I believe that most of us who have been trying to practice any spiritual tradition will have these moments where we feel that we're being called to level up, right? We're being called to step beyond what our comfort zone to a new level of resonance. And these last few years have definitely been that for me, especially the last year or two. And I think it's really important that we reanimate our own spiritual lives with our heart, that we take it as our own, you know, and that there's no way that anyone else can live your tradition for you. You have to be constantly you know, I once was with Bhakti Tirtha Swami, and he told me one of the most fascinating things. He said that he is a devotee of Krishna and a member of ISKCON because it's the best thing that he's found anywhere. And that if he finds something better, he leaves tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I can't imagine how many people will find that shocking and bordering betrayal and heresy. But yeah, it speaks about the spirit of a true seeker.
And it means that he's applying his whole self to being a devotee of ISKCON, and that he's not, like you talked about compartmentalization. This is something I feel also strongly about. It's not easy, but why should we nourish schizophrenia in our souls? We should be able to at least privately be the same person at church that we are at work, that we are with our friends, that we are with our lover, beloved, this, that. We should be one being. And even if we may not share it with everyone, like we keep some things private, but the idea that we actually are compartmentalizing our soul.
Integration is crucial. Wholeness, right?
Wholeness.
These are words that I like more even than words than transcendence. I have nothing against the word transcendence, but for some it's something far away, future time, above the clouds, not here, not now.
Mm.
And for me, it's more important than to cultivate here and now who I want to be and to make it in a way that, again, it's normal. Again, we're normal. This, we should be normal.
We should be normal. Yeah, yeah. You know, Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, who he's getting older, but he's one of the great scholars, students of Srila Prabhupada over the last, decades. And
yeah, I've been going through his thesis that he wrote decades ago, getting some things for a book I'm writing now. Yeah,
amazing, amazing. He jokes that one day maybe I'll become a pure devotee,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe one day after that I will become a nice person.
Okay, I was waiting for something like that—a human being, a nice person.
He tells a funny story that he was chanting japa in the morning on the porch, and there was a sunrise, and he went out, and there was one lady there, and they were, in the old days, men and ladies didn't know how to communicate properly, so he's trying to be polite. He's older, he's the temple president, so he says to her, "Isn't it a beautiful sunrise?" And she's just in this like fanatical young devotee. She says, "It's not beautiful. It's here in the material world and it's horrible. And because you think it's beautiful, you're going to have to come back life after life to enjoy the sunrise."
With all respect and love for the little girl that say that, but that's the beginning of a cult, basically, right? And we are not, our tradition is not a cult, but it can be totally misrepresented in so many cultish ways. And I've heard that's one example of thousands of bizarre, surreal ways of thinking that maybe we all went through to some degree or another, and we can laugh about it so we don't cry.
But laughing about it is also part of the healthy side of it, is to see that it is, it is, immature at best.
Yeah. And regarding what you just gave, the example you gave, right? Like this sunrise, horrible material world, let's get out of here. For me, this is one of the core misunderstandings. And I'm not here pointing to ISKCON, I'm talking in general, even beyond Gaudiya Vaishnavism, in other traditions, that religious traditions that become too much like otherworldly oriented.
Right.
Like our practice is just an evacuation plan. We need to get out of here as soon as possible. Evacuation plan into the afterlife. And all here is trap. All here is obstacle. All here is trying to take us down. We become very conspiratorial in that sense, in a negative sense. Like Maya Shakti wants me to take me down. Yeah. Rather than seeing the sunrise and seeing Krishna there, really, and seeing something beautiful, sacred, inspiring, and even seeing the material energy, as I like to emphasize, and people get shocked many times, but it's Maya Shakti is a Vaishnavi. In the scripture, it says she's serving God. It's an energy serving God, so we have to honor her.
what power do we have to dishonor her? With we have no, we're depending on her mercy to get our passing grade on the exam.
And Maya in Sanskrit, interestingly, one meaning for Maya is mercy.
Interesting.
So depending how we approach that department, we will feel it one way or another, right?
Yeah. And then so Prabhupada's, the counterpoint is Prabhupada's comment was, if you think the sunrise is beautiful, you should see the artist.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Prabhupada's comment. When someone said, "Oh, it's such a beautiful sunrise." He said, "If you think the painting is beautiful, wait till you meet the painter."
Yeah. No. So we are all having constant trailers here around us of the what will mean to meet the artist, right? So yeah, sambandha, right? Like seeing everything in connection to Krishna, in connection to the source.
Right.
When the source is properly established, there's nothing to reject, basically.
Right, right. And yet we are in this world dealing with these world problems, So this period, basically what happened to me is out of the blue, within 12 hours or something, I suddenly noticed that I was having, I thought they were flower stains, because I had just been to the flower fest. I thought they were rose stains. Mm. In the morning, I was okay. I had suddenly black marks on my body and in my mouth. And I called a friend. They sent me for a blood test. I was in the ICU like that. My platelets had dropped from 250,000 before I left for India. I had a test, and then 1,000, which luckily at the time I didn't read all the things that could have happened, but the things that could happen with it's really shocking. So, you know, this is also the reality of material energy, you know, that we are surrounded, you know, there's a Kabbalah, Jewish Kabbalah saying that nothing could survive without divine energy. And that's why every blade of grass has an angel hovering over it, whispering, grow, 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 grow. Because everything, how else could anything survive in this world, you know? So all the things that could possibly go wrong constantly, it's a miracle, you know? Hmm. So there's one of my favorite verses, Srila Prabhupada talks in Bhagavad Gita 4:24, his purport. He's basically talking about how even though we are spiritual energy, spiritual creatures, Brahman in our essence, Satchit Ananda, we are immersed in material energy. And so it is in this realm that we must act and use the energies around us to free ourselves from this energy. And of course, the classic example he gives is yogurt for a stomach ache. If you eat too much, you know, milk sweets in India, you get sick, and then you need yogurt to counter. So it's the same substance somehow or other still healing you. So you know, this razor's edge of the material energy, how to interact with it in a way where we are actually, you know, becoming free by the mercy, by the grace.
Yeah, relating to the substance, like following the yogurt example, relating to the substance in a way that becomes medicine.
Right. Somehow or other transforming it into medicinal, yeah.
Yeah, how to relate to matter in a way that is healing me, that is medicine for me and not making me sick. So at the end of the day, it's not that the milk product in itself was bad. It's just I had an overdose of it, or I took it in the wrong way. But in the properly approach, it can be healing and medicine.
It's so much of even physics, as little as I understand it, and spiritual life has to do with our relationship, right? This is where it goes back. You said sambandha. This is where it goes back to that essential teaching of bhakti that, and, you know, Einstein, you know, our relationship with our reality is making our reality.
Yeah, because reality is relational, right?
Relational.
Reality without relationship is no reality at all.
Right.
Yeah.
My wife and I have read this book by this man, Terry Real, who is a family, he calls it relational life therapy, and it's about... You might enjoy reading his work.
Please tell me more about it. Yeah.
It's focused on family therapy, couple therapy, and helping people to realize that there's you, there's me, and there's us. And he stretches it out into the world as well to say that our relationship with nature is not nature. It's not us, but it's our relational reality together, you know, and that a husband may be correct in his perspective, a wife may be correct in her perspective, but when they come together, a new reality is created, and that new reality has new rules and a whole new set of norms, and you must function within that relational reality.
Yeah, and I cannot avoid thinking of Sankirtan here, right? Because we can... As I like to say, we can do kirtan by our own, and that's some. I can do some kirtan, but sankirtan, I need you. I need you. I need it. We need each other for sankirtan to happen. As bringing each one's perspective and making it a collective, like an orchestra, right? Each musician have their talent. You put all together, and even the orchestra director finds himself doing things that he could never do by himself, but he's taken to another level by the alchemy of the collective, right? So
I find Sankirtan such a beautiful metaphor for the whole package. Mm-hmm. As a professional musician, I realized years ago that if you sterilize the kirtan experience and make it perfect, it's imperfect.
Yeah.
So in recordings, we will go in and add messiness to make it more like a real kirtan, because if you sterilize it, it loses its je ne sais quoi.
Yeah. It makes me think of this, some of these famous painters who will do a perfect off painting and then will put like some line of another color just to bring messiness to the equation, right, to make it real.
Yeah, so we will add a party track at the end. So you do everything nicely, carefully, and then at the end, you just have everyone clapping and singing and dancing, and you just put it nicely, quietly in the background. So it brings that, you know, someone a little off tune, someone, you know, clapping a little off time, and actually... even technically, like as a guitar player, there are effects that you put on flange or phaser to warp the sound a little bit so that it creates a softness or a glow that then creates more attraction and beauty and curiosity.
Yeah, and also I think it unconsciously probably all this, but it makes the kirtan in this case more relatable to the person, because it includes imperfection, which is what in one sense life is about. Like one teacher of mine will say, perfection is not the exclusion of imperfection. Perfection is the inclusion of imperfection. It's so perfect that it can even give place to imperfection.
Oh, beautiful.
That's real perfection, not the exclusion of it.
Yeah.
So what do we do with the Yeah, I remember, maybe you know this story, going to the music beyond the kirtan area, but to Miles Davis for a moment, to the jazz department. And he was once playing with Herbie Hancock, who will be a piano player. And Herbie Hancock tells the story that once he played the wrong note, right? Because again, as much as jazz is about improvisation, still there are some parameters so that you can do anything and everything. No? Because some people think, oh, improvising means you do whatever you want. No, there is some perimeter.
There's still a relational reality within jazz.
Exactly. So Miles Davis while playing, and Herbie Hancock hits the wrong note, and he's like, oh my gosh, he's waiting for Miles Davis to reduce him to ashes with his sight. And what Miles Davis did was picking up on that wrong note and starting a whole new melodic pattern and continuing. Right, so the imperfection had a place into the big equation. For me, that's again a big metaphor to life.
Sure, there's a jazz idiom or something. They say, if you play it wrong the first time, it's a mistake. The second time, it's a riff. And the third time, it's a style.
Okay. it's a very hopeful perspective for us dealing with our own shortcomings on a daily basis. Because again, going back to our practice, our spiritual practice, many times, and you use the word neurotizing before, like sometimes we neurotize or stigmatize things that we should normalize. Mm. Like there will be messiness, there will be ups and downs, there will be imperfection, shortcomings, and all that's part, going back to your quote on Ravindra's Rupro, it's part of being a good person, a human being.
A human being.
No, not just being a superhero, devotional superhero, first devotional human being.
Right. There's a beautiful book called Francis, The Journey and the Dream, which is a poetic retelling of the life of Francis by a Franciscan poet, Father Murray Bodo. I don't know if you're familiar with this book.
I'll check, because in a few months we have a retreat in La Verna, the place where Francis received the stigmata. So
yeah.
Maybe good.
I love all those areas of Assisi. I've had some mystical experiences there. I really do love Francis. And this book, you have to read this book in preparation for this retreat, 100%. It's an easy read.
Repeat the name again.
Francis, The Journey and the Dream by Father Murray Bodo.
Okay.
And he brings out the human side of Francis so elegantly. And it makes you love and appreciate his contribution even more because of the humanity, not despite the humanity.
And I will say, in our tradition, when we speak about Krishna, what makes Krishna Lila Vrindavan especially charming and sweet, as we talked before, is the humanity of it. It's Nara Lila, it's a human, we say sometimes human-like pastime, But for me, the like in human-like is not that it's pseudo-human.
Right.
That is human and divine, fully human right. and fully divine. We don't know what's fully divine yet, and we don't know what's fully human yet. But for me, what makes Krishna Lila or Gaur Lila relatable is like, oh, it's so human.
Mm.
It's so charming. If I take the human element out, we no longer have Krishna's
that charm, that sweetness.
Yeah, the proximity, the intimacy, the prospect of close connection and the charm of it. So,
you know, once Radhanath Swami was encouraging me in my spiritual life, and he said, don't think that if you don't meet the mark, you're letting me down.
Mm.
And then after making that point very strongly, you know, and I was crying and I was feeling so grateful, he said, but also remember, you could choose to lift me up,
mm-hmm.
right? That both are there, that we're in this together, and that as my teacher, I have also a relationship to support him. It's not a one-sided relationship, right?
It's reciprocal, right?
It's reciprocal. And that's to that human sweetness that keeps increasing, ultimately until the veil is lifted and we're allowed to enter fully into that divine and human Leela with the Lord himself and his close devotees.
Yeah.
This is all training for that, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. I the other day I shared a section from a letter of Prabhupada to one of his disciples.
Mm.
And he says, basically, you depend on my mercy, and I depend on your mercy, Prabhupada.
Wow.
It is reciprocal. It's a loving relationship. It is reciprocal. Something like that, right?
And it's not, you know, it's not just a hyperbolic statement of humility or something Prabhupada actually genuinely felt
it was not
that
a show.
Way.
Exactly. Yeah.
My mother tells, this is a little side anecdote story, that there was a very difficult time where there was a lot of deadlines being missed in the construction of the Krishna Balaram temple, and there was a lot of pressure because all these huge people were coming for the opening of this one of Prabhupada's first primary temples in India, and there's like I said, and Prabhupada was so frustrated that these delays and everything, and because promises had been made. It was okay if promises had not been made, but then, you know, that. So he was in a very kind of, my mother said, lion-like mood. And then he was out one day, and the devotees who were the team of artists had created these sculptures of the gopis. And they put them in Prabhupada's room just to show the work that they had done. And Prabhupada came back and he saw these gopis there in his room. And Prabhupada just became like a child, and he was just full of enthusiasm. And then he looking at them, and then he turned to the devotees and he said to them, you are all like them. You are all like them.
Mm.
You know, that was Prabhupada's real feeling. It's like, you are the gopis. You are all doing the service, Lord. You're all like the gopis. You know?
Mm. Beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful. And so humbly, I can imagine, for those disciples to hear their own guru. Yeah, in that. Truly, as you say, no? I'm sure they didn't feel, oh, Prabhupada is flattering us, he's faking humility. They were melting.
There's one scene in The Journey and the Dream with Francis, in this book.
Yeah.
Where I love. I think about this quite often, actually. So when Francis was a young man, he was a noble kind of birth. Wealthy.
Yeah, his father worked with silk. He has
silk,
quite a lot
like
of
this,
money.
Right? So, kind of in the, you know, at the time, there's principalities, kind of in the noble realm, mm-hmm. and, you know, not like a prince, but like a prince, you know. And he used to go to parties dressed as a troubadour when he was a young teenager. He would dress in the clothes of, like, you know, basically like a you know, a pop star, you know, and
yeah,
he would
sing the life of the party,
and he had his lute, and he would sing songs, and he was life of the party, and he would sing pop songs and all these love songs. So sometimes when they were walking, when he became, you know, a monk, he would just start singing a song, and it would be sometimes one of the old songs of his youth, of these pop songs, you know, which reminds me of Sri Chaitanya.
That's
and
what I was thinking at this precise moment. Mahaprabhu and Ratha Yatra singing this song.
So he would sing these songs, and, you know, there would be always a sense of humor about them, like, you know, because these songs were always full of love and this and that, and sometimes they'd be feeling very lonely. And actually, he'd be really speaking about the loneliness, but singing as him, like, I'm with my beloved and we're walking in the fields. But it's like he's feeling actually quite alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes that sometimes, because it was Claire had her order and Francis has his order. It was mostly men. He was mostly hanging out with men at, you know. And so they would sometimes wrestle. They would like do, you know, physical wrestling with these, you know, as like exercise and mm-hmm. expression. And so Francis was singing and he describes he became very quiet and everyone could feel the mood dropped and he became quite depressed and sad. So they're walking and one of the other brothers thinks, oh, let me go rough him up and, you know, cheer him up. So he goes and he kind of grabs him and he starts wrestling him, and he gets him to the ground and he realizes Francis is weeping. Mm. He's crying. Just a very tough day. And so this big muscly guy, he lifts up Francis in his arms and he carries him as they walk.
Mm.
This is spiritual brotherhood and sisterhood to me.
Yeah.
Fearless, you know, not judging. My guru is weak. My guru has become weak. My guru should be always this, like you said, the spiritual hero and always, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, that's unrelatable, right? Also, if we force ourselves to see not only our guru, but anyone or everyone who is in your, like, infallible, ever perfect, we don't have a point of reference for our own journey.
Right.
So I cannot, it doesn't give me hope, actually.
Sometimes it doesn't give me hope. It makes me hopeless.
Yeah, sometimes we think, no, you are a leader. You should be perfect for the community to nourish their faith. And with good intention, we may do that.
Sure.
But that creates a very unhealthy, unrealistic pattern because it set the bar so high that it's unrealistic. Nobody can actually relate to that. And eventually that disturbs the faith. Rather than
disturbs the faith, yeah. And I think this is where, in our healthiest, that we can find, I mean, you know, within our own tradition, outside our own tradition, we can find these brothers and sisters to encourage each other and to be, you know, full of hope and full of, you know, that, you know, that, and this is where recently I've found in my difficult time over this last year, health challenges and other things, this thing in India was really like the straw that broke the camel's back. But I had been reading this book, this Rumi translations by Coleman Barks. You know, not all of the stories are relatable or even recommended by me. There's a lot of stuff.
We won't go into the details now publicly.
But there are so many stories of encouragement and faith. And when you see them sometimes reflected outside your tradition, it helps you to find it inside your own heart. And
I personally always love to say, and my second book, Radical Personalism, is very much about this. It's for me trying to, after one of my biggest crises in my life, in connection to the tradition and to a figure of in the tradition, and again, liminal space, as you were talking, thrown into a liminal space. So who am I now? How to continue and how to... I want to continue being a practitioner, but how to embrace my tradition in a way that is relevant, relatable, not creating my own philosophy. No, I did not go into the point like I adjust everything so it's comfortable for me. No. But also there are things that how they are being sometimes told or practiced or represented does not resonate. And I'm not saying that healthy fruits are coming from that in me or others. So how to rediscover, basically, how to find a deeper version of it. And that took me to that unique journey in which, basically I ended up rediscovering my tradition, and big part of that happened by the grace of other traditions.
Right.
And I quote them other, I like to call them sister traditions.
Sure.
And I go to mystical Christianity or to Sufism. And again, I'm not saying everything is entirely the same, because if not, we will call them all with the same name.
Right.
But they are similar and close enough to allow the inspiration for one to go back and rediscover your own tradition by the grace of those sister traditions.
Right.
Like, oh, they're articulating this in this way. They are saying this in this way. Oh, in our tradition, we say this way, but I never thought it this way. So thank you, mystical Christianity, for that articulation.
Right, right. There's that, I'm seeing if I can pull it up, but there's that Bhaktivinoda Thakur quote, I may not have it, about, you know, that true interfaith dialogue is to see your beloved Lord in the clothing and at the time of another people and see how wonderful is my Lord that he appeared to this person in this place at this time.
Yeah, I quote that section in my book, actually. And he said, when we go to a church or to a mosque, we should think like you just say, like, wow, how incredible how they worship my... And that's for me the actual essential thread in our tradition thinking, for example, in about Brihadbhagavatamrita and Gopakumar's journey.
Right.
Like he's on a journey and he has his own call to relate to Krishna in Vrindavan as a friend. But on his way, he finds so many other people, so many other practitioners and devotees, so many other religions, if you will. And he appreciates all of them. It's not that he's going there with a superiority complex, all of you are inferior, you are not Gaudiya Vaishnav, you're not. He's learning from them, staying with them, being nourished by them, and continuing his journey. So making their gifts part of his journey, basically, right?
Mm, yeah.
So for me, that's the ideal
taking that gold and beauty and recognizing the source that it comes from and not being ungrateful for that beauty and that grace that shows up from divine source.
No need to feel threatened either, right, because it's all one team, so to say.
Beautiful. Yeah. I was thinking maybe it might be a good time to share some music.
Why not?
With you, if you're open.
Please.
I have.
I would love to accompany you, being a musician myself, but it will be a little messy. And I know we love to put messiness into the musical equation, but this will be too much. So you will do your part, and I will bear witness.
Well, let me your gift. Quickly tune up my guitar here. You can obviously edit this later to make the transition more smooth.
Which one you are thinking about? Which offering?
Well,
you're going to bring to the table.
Yeah, it's a good question. So you had you had suggested a song that I shared with you. About fear, and so let me share that one. It's one of the newest songs I've written, and it's not yet released. Let's see if we can.
By the time we are recording, probably by the time we are sharing, it's released.
Let's see if we can make it work. Let's see if we can make it work like that. Otherwise, we can find some other creative way. But I'll share two songs if it's okay. Actually, if we weren't recording this podcast, I would share a new song. Even I wrote a song with my mother in the hospital.
Now I'm tempted about that one.
which I would love to. Is there a limit to your recording capabilities, Maharaj?
Teacher will say, to the endlessness, no limit.
I always make the mistake of wanting to share these new songs before their time.
You can finish the song before the 5 seconds before the official end, so you are not sharing the full session. It's not before it's released. It's a trailer.
Well, we can figure out later. We can share some
no portion. Problem.
This is Fear. So as I've traveled around this world, I've realized we're in a timeless battle with fear. And it's fear versus love. You know, some people think it's love and hate, but it's actually love and fear are in opposition, in my perspective. And we really have nothing to fear but fear itself. And what we actually need, all we need is love. We're in a timeless battle with fear. It's fear versus love.
with nothing to fear but fear itself, and all we need is love. I'm afraid of rattlesnakes, lasers and landmines, elevators, taxes, dentists and deadlines, volcanoes, tornadoes, poison in the fettuccine Alfredo, microwaves, Shakespeare's plays, whoever the hell killed JFK. We're in a timeless battle with fear. Fear versus love. With nothing to fear but fear itself, and all we need is love. Microplastics, trans fats, followed down the street by a black cat, teenagers on Snapchat, Republicans and Democrats, cannibals from Borneo, clowns from Kalamazoo. I'm afraid to be myself, a little bit afraid to be like you. Oh. But I believe love will conquer all. I believe one day fear will fall. And we'll dance on his bones, and it'll sound like the we're gonna dance on his bones. Love, it burns like, it burns like a forest fire. Love is deeper than a mountain cave. Love will tear down even the greatest empire, 'cause love is stronger than a tidal wave. Love, sing it out now. Love, I'm afraid to say that I'm afraid today, and I'm afraid tomorrow it's gonna be more of the same. 'Cause I'm afraid to live, afraid to die, afraid to laugh, afraid to cry. I'm afraid to be afraid, afraid I don't know why. Oh, we're in a timeless battle with fear. Fear versus love. With nothing to fear but fear itself, and all we need is love. Now, all you people out there in TV land, you can sing with me. Last line, we can do it together. And all we need is love. And all we need is love. All we need is Radha and Krishna. Oh, all we need is love.
Thank you so much. I love the song. I remember, just to bring the story, like you were rehearsing that in Germany when we were there, and I was staying in a room up to yours, and I was secretly listening to the rehearsal. It's like, oh, I like.
You were forced to join all my rehearsals.
I loved it. And eventually we had an event after Bhakti Bloom, and I requested you publicly to sing it. Yeah. Which, in one sense, the song is about fear. But again, at the end of the day, the song is about love, right?
Right.
And yeah, there's a point that I like to bring to this. And I don't think it contradicts what you just sang about. But when we really inhabit love and embrace and are embraced by love fully, in that sense, we no longer can speak about an opposite to love. Right? For someone who knows love, like again, Saint Francis, Srila Prabhupada, whomever, Abhay, right? Fearless. Fear disappears from the equation, and love has no opposite anymore. It's love, and the only other option is more love.
Right. Yeah, I love that you brought up Srila Prabhupada, because Abhay Charanaravinda, fearless in full shelter of the divine, you know, at the feet of the divine, fearless in full shelter. And I have recently, when doing the song, mentioned Prabhupada and his name, and that, you know, how do we become fearless? And, you know, as part of this journey for me over the last few years, I've recognized that fear is actually through, you know, our subconscious is actually connecting us to our original spiritual nature, that the fear is the symptom of that soul trying to express itself through the mortal coil and through the layers of whatever abuse or difficulty or challenge that we face. It comes out as fear. But if we can, you know, trace it back, we will find that the root of fear is love, which is, you know, another way of saying what you're saying.
Yeah, love is ultimately the root of everything, right? Yeah,
right. That's the bhakti side of it, that love is ultimately the root of all things.
But as you say, beautifully connecting Abhay with Charanaravindam, okay, how to become fearless? You cannot just bully people into fearlessness, right? Like, become fearless.
Right. But instantly.
They have to feel enough trust and confidence and love supporting them for them to, whatever, confront their fears and be courageous. Because if there's not that foundation of hope and trust and confidence and love, we become frozen, basically.
Right.
Right.
Right. And this is what, so Freud was the, I'm not so good at this stuff, but Freud was the guru, and
Carl Jung.
And Jung, they, one of the ways that they diverged from each other is Jung felt that all of these things had a spiritual root and that connected not to be run away from, but to be moved towards in our own story and development of our own curiosity and our own discovery.
There is one question that comes to my mind that I like to ask you, since we are talking about anything and everything, in connection to this, hopefully, and in speaking about integration and wholeness and dealing with fear and dealing with trauma and trying to grow beyond it. You mentioned in your bio you were raised by monks. And I'm asking this, the question, because, of course, I can imagine for many, at least in some cases, they are bringing in a gurukul in a traditional, I don't know, Vedic or Indian setting with monks or whatever. Sometimes it's a complex mixture of beautiful mystical memories and experiences, but sometimes also traumatic stuff that ended up in forms of religious PTSD.
Sure.
So without necessarily going into specific details or anything, but I don't know if you have anything to share about that, or if you have gone through some of that, how was your journey of integration? Because it's good, again, to have points of reference.
Yeah. Well, so my family had gone home from India. We had been traveling together, and then my family went home, and when I got hit with this blood platelet emergency, my mother was there, and she decided to stay with me in the hospital for this time. And we wrote a song together while in the hospital based on a poem that she had written from the city of Udaipur. And Udaipur is connected to the history of Mirabai, the poet, lover of Krishna. And this time with my mother, in many ways, was the longest time I had spent with my mother since I was a baby.
Yeah.
Because as a young, at four, I went in to live in the ashram, and I was living there. And then when I later went to live with my mother as a preteen, after Gurukula, she was busy, I was busy, and we never, so this time of having me and my mother in the same room was like, since I was 3 years old, you know, it was so that was quite interesting.
You were kind of in a baby-like state, like having to be taken for. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it was challenging and intense to be in that, inhabiting that same space also. I know that I'm reflecting on what you said earlier, that, you know, people who are too much in the mood of transcendence, trying to escape the material world and see everything as something we have to run away from, you know, that they never are dealing with reality as it is. At the same time, I do feel that there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that this is not the natural place for the soul, that this is not the home for the soul. And Prabhupada gives the example sometimes of the jail. And mm-hmm. I've extruded that analogy to talk about it as an insane asylum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may all be patients in an insane asylum, and we're doing our best to try and, okay, today, everyone, we're going to do a play together, and you're going to be a doctor, and you're going to be the mailman, and you're going to come in, and you're going to be the clown. And you know, someone starts thinking, I'm a clown, I'm a doctor. It's like, no, it's a play. We're doing this to help heal. We're all having mental illness. Oh. We're doing a play. It's not real. Real life is outside of the insane asylum, everyone. Yeah. We're going to remind you this is not real. It's just a play. So in that sense, I do think it's important to recognize that for the soul, like, you know, as Helen Keller, the famous American.
I just shared a post of her 3 days ago.
Wonderful. So, you know, she's speaking through sign language. And, you know, she was a Swedenborgian Christian, which is a very interesting group of Christians, a revolutionary group of Christians from, I think, the early teens. And she said, I believe in the eternality of the soul because I have immortal longings. And for me, that is one of the evidences, one of the fingerprints of divine reality. Why are we so attracted to life if everyone we know dies? It should be very natural. Death should be very, very natural for all of us. Mm. Ugliness and death and pain, all these things that are a natural part of this world should be very normalized. But we want beauty. We want love. We want eternity. We want friendship, even in the midst of loneliness. Why do we want these things? These longings, Helen Keller says, are proof of the nature of the soul. And I also recognize that if you just let the chatter fade and you just hear your own heart, what are you longing for? Those things, they're from the soul, they're natural, you know. So I know that everyone in life has trauma and difficulty, and I've tried really hard to not blame my own spiritual tradition for failings that have resulted in my own traumatic life and upbringing. And I have tried with my wife to really raise our children. You know, as Radhana Swami says, all you have to do is not make the same mistakes we made. Then you'll be great, you know. So we've tried to raise our children that whenever Krishna is involved, whenever there's something to do with spiritual life, it's fun, it's joyful, it's cool, it's awesome, it's interesting, it's curious. And our kids are these wonderful, curious devotees who are naturally excavating their own tradition on their own terms. And, you know, try to walk that balance and give them some of that, you know, to let them rediscover Krishna and share it with themselves and their friends and their world, you know, on their own terms.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe you already replied to this, but since you mentioned your kids and you being a father, will you say that? I always like to ask that to fathers and mothers, especially because me as a sannyasi, I like the first-hand experience of that, though I have to engage in another form of having kids.
You have many children. We only have three.
It reminds me of one situation in Argentina. Once I was giving a lecture and someone raised his hand very, like, shaking, and he said, like, oh, you can talk about all these things and have time to practice the things because you don't have kids. I have, like, 8 kids. And he started then to, I don't have time for anything. And the natural thing for me was to say, first, you chose to have the 8 kids, so please don't complain. Then, like, I don't have biological kids, but I have of the other ones, and there are way more than 7 or 8 than any number you can have biological.
And they have the same needs and the same.
Yeah,
all
if
the
I
same.
Took sannyas to get rid of having kids, I made the wrong choice because I'm in a bigger trouble.
Yeah, the whole world is your family. Yeah.
But still, I like to ask parents, like, what did, for example, for you becoming a father, what did becoming a father teach you that years of spiritual practice did not? Let's put it that way.
I have to say that being a father is the best and most powerful thing that I've done. Now, it's because I believe that my wife is also a Bhakta, my parents are Bhaktas, her parents are Bhaktas, that our kids love kirtan, their friends and family. So everything is always inside this context of spiritual life in the broad sense.
Yeah.
But because of that, there's nothing that I've done that's more beautiful and challenging. My kids are smart, and there have been a couple of times where I've gone to them for advice that I couldn't go to anyone else for, and they gave me this brilliant advice. You know, gosh, and it was hard to take, but it was just the right perfect thing, you know. So I'm very, very lucky, and I know that there's always karma involved, and I'm just so grateful for this opportunity to be a father to these amazing children, and to my wife also. I don't say it enough, but the only way that I've been able to spend the last 20 plus years as a musician sharing bhakti and Krishna is because of my wife, who has been home when I was not home, who has been taking care of, I would maybe take one of the children, but that means the other two children are at home with her, you know, and she has been the fortress that I can return to, in my bhakti life. And I don't say it enough, but I'm so incredibly grateful to her for that.
Thank you. Thank you. And I always love to ask this question, especially as a sannyasi, to sober myself in the sense that I'm not someone, I don't consider myself someone who is overtly, let's renounce everything and everyone has to become a monk and everyone has to become sannyasi at some point. Because as I like to say, in our tradition, our goal is to live as cowherd people in eternity. So nobody will be a sannyasi there. So
everyone's going to be a family.
I better
man,
not become woman. Too much attached to my saffron class. but also just to show how, because again, as you know, family life has been sometimes even unnecessarily stigmatized or downplayed, or that's necessary entangling and bad. And you can learn so much, grow so much in responsibility and sacrifice and relationality. And so, I mean, again, in Vrindavan, there is eternally family life for eternity. You know, everyone is living in their homes with their families. So there is a way that all that shouldn't be a problem. So I appreciate what you're mentioning. And Gorbani, you're mentioning also, you mentioned how in your case, also your wife, but in your case, you were born in a family of devotees, Gaudiya Vaishnavas. So Krishna consciousness has been, in one sense, your family religion, so to say.
Sure.
But I'm wondering, and I ask this, as I ask every parent what I just ask you, I also ask every Gurukuli or second generation devotee this, when did Krishna consciousness stop being inherited and start being chosen? If you had any moment in your life where you felt, okay, I'm coming with this momentum of being a devotee from my family, but have I chosen voluntarily to thread this path, or no need for that? How it was your experience?
There's two answers. One is, I remember I was some folks may know this, but I got randomly, a friend of mine dragged me to an audition at Paramount Studios in Hollywood. I was going to a art high school in Hollywood, and I would take the bus a few hours every day. And then one day after school, someone said, there's this open audition, let's go to this audition. So I ended up in Hollywood, and I have some movies. I was an actor in the Screen Actors Guild. I had an agent, and I was like, this is a little life that I had before I realized that I really was a musician, and I didn't want to be an actor, actually. So I left, and I joined the temple. I shaved my head, and I went and became a monk. And I called it was something I always wanted to do. I called my manager, and I said, I've joined the Hare Krishnas. You know, I told them, you know. But that was the external side of it. The truth is, like Bhakti Tirtha Swami said, I join every day. I rejoin ISKCON. So you say that you're not officially part of ISKCON. Well, I'll say I wake up in the morning and I'm not officially part of ISKCON. And then I join the movement again sometime between breakfast and lunch or something like this every day, you know. We have to be alive with our spiritual traditions. Yeah. So I believe it's an active thing. Like, just like the word love, people say love is a verb. So to be a devotee means to be devoted. And it's something I have to redo every day. Mm-hmm. I have to recommit myself every day.
Yeah. Thank you. That will be my way of replying also. Yeah. Like you say, membership is a daily choice.
Yes.
Right. And vows are not taken only once, but you have to renew your vows on a daily basis as well. Yeah, I've
took daily, sannyas even 17 on a moment years by ago, moment basis.
What it means to be a sannyas, what it means to be a father, what it means to be a husband is a daily update and upgrade of the answer to that question, right?
Right, because we change, the world changes.
You briefly referred to before to your recent health situation, or if you want to call it health crisis. For me, crisis is not a bad word, it's just turning point, right? Invitation for out of the blue, as you said, and I like to connect that with Krishna, who is black or blue, so it's out of the blue. So how this recent health crisis, for example, altered your sense of identity, even?
Right,
because I'm thinking identity. If, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to sound fatalistic, but let's say if tomorrow you could no longer perform due to health issues, who will Gauravani be? Right? Because you still are there. So how it all plays out with how you see yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, this is the question. These are the questions. Recently, I came into the awareness that sometimes the open questions are better than the answers.
Yes. There's this poem by Rilke. I don't want to interrupt you, but he will say he will say, we have to fall in love with the question rather than the answers. And when we stay enough with the questions, eventually the questions blossom into the answers we needed, actually. But we have to sit enough time with the questions themselves.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the questioning, the curiosity, the adventure. Some of the best stories are stories that seem to continue to unfold after the book closes, you know, that there would be more. Who am I? Who am I? Ke Ami. This is one of my favorite moments in the Gaura Lila and the story of Lord Chaitanya, that one of the most influential, wealthy, and famous humans in the known world goes to Sri Chaitanya and asks, Ke Ami. Everyone else thinks they know who I am, but I don't know who I am. Who am I? And I was joking with my wife, you know, it's these days you have to be in social media to be doing music. You have to be active and making followers and getting likes and comments. After years, I never took social media seriously because it felt very inauthentic to me. And so now I'm 20 years behind everyone else on social media. You know, it's like
good luck.
I have 50,000 followers on Instagram or whatever. And I'm one of the first users of Instagram. When I got on there, it was for sharing pictures with friends, you know, it was just photographs, you know. So who am I? Who am I? You know, am I social? I was joking with my wife that if I was to die, can I keep my Instagram account so that in my next life as a musician, I can start with 50,000 followers? Like,
please.
Oh, Lord.
Krishna, give me that mercy. Let's be done.
Oh, Dhruva, what do you want?
I want
to start life with 50,000 followers.
Those are the new types of prayer that are emerging in the times you are living, right?
My gosh. Yes, my identity. I definitely feel very, very connected to Krishna through singing and music. And for example, in these songs that I've shared with you, I think in some ways I feel that I've shared more of who I am than the words that I say. But I recognize that who I am is yet to be fully revealed. You know, in our tradition, we have the idea of Siddha Deha, Siddha Swarup, that your spiritual form will be revealed to you. And I don't know. I like to joke, though, that not that I actually think that this is my Siddha Deha, but I have an idea that I have a rock band.
You told me that in Germany, please.
With frogs.
Reveal your these esoteric details to the public. So in our tradition,
so every day,
we try not to reveal those publicly, but anyhow.
Every day, me and my rock band of frogs, we come out of the mud in the Yamuna and we bang rocks and sticks and leaves and we make a band. And Krishna and the Coward Boys come and they're like, "Oh, that was a good one, the hit for the day." You know, we're like, rah, 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 rah. So, I don't know. Who am I? Am I a father? Am I a Gurukuli? I don't know. It's a very good question. And definitely when things get broken down, I'm someone who has thought a lot about the last moments of my life, and I don't know what they will be, but maybe, Maharaj, I will be on my deathbed and I will be looking at everyone I know and I will have to close my eyes and say goodbye to everyone knowing that I'm stepping. I don't know who I am, you know?
Yeah. And staying with that and knowing also, it's so uncomfortable, but so necessary, right? Like sitting with the question, like it's an open question, it's disclosure, it's not bringing closure, like full certitude. And
right. It's bringing an openness.
Yeah.
It's bringing an openness.
But the openness in itself gives hope and excitement, right? Because if it's just closed, conclusive, dead end, then what after, right?
Absolutely. You know, Krishna, by definition, is surprising and unlimited and spontaneous. And so, mama mana mandire, please, oh Krishna, make a residence in the core of my heart. And in that moment where I'm in transition out of one identity and into the other, please, you come and you enter into that core inner space of my heart. And you show me who I am through my association with you.
Yeah. But I really appreciate how you emphasize it's an ongoing question, given the example of Sanatana Goswami. Like he will say, well, he was Sanatana Goswami. He didn't need to ask who I am. And someone will say, no, it was his humility or he asked for us, and fine. But also you could say, even if you have discovered or connected with your Siddha Deha, Siddha Swarup, still you can always ask, who am I? There's always a new answer. I remember being in an immense retreat last year and we sat in a circle, we were like five, and the prompt was replying to the question, who am I? So everyone was first round like, okay, my name is this, I live here, I work, live. The circle ends. We're waiting to the next question, which was, who I am? So another level of answer to the same question.
Right.
And we were
right
there like 3 hours going through the same question, like who knows how many times.
That's lovely. That's
and
lovely.
That made for me like, okay, this and perennial question. It should never.
It's a perennial question. And the sweetness of a spiritual tradition is that if we're soft and gentle, like I respect you as my spiritual elder because you are in the position of a sannyasi and a teacher. And also it's beautiful when that can disappear and then we find another relationship that's also there.
Yeah.
Of friends, friendship. And brothers in poetry, brothers in appreciation of poetry.
And all that and, sounds to me more close to how we want to relate in eternity
right
than just a role, a cloth, a name. I mean, not to entirely downplay that, but yeah.
Sure.
Like Mahaprabhu himself said, Naham Bipro, I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not this, I'm not a sannyasi. Though he was a sannyasi. So yeah, on some level, I'm a sannyasi, but I'm not a sannyasi, and I don't want to relate to people from the podium or from the role. You are also a singer, a father, but at the end of the day, we want to be friends and brothers and sisters and
and lovers of Krishna. So who are we in relationship to our beloved? You know, and if Krishna is in one mood one day, then I may have to put on the role of a sannyasi to play the role in some leela that, you know.
Yeah, because again, that's the thing. Krishna is not a fixed entity that it's always the same person, always thinking the same way, it's ever evolving. So we have to keep the pace with his ever evolvingness. And as we ask continuously, who am I? We can ask also, who is Krishna today? right?
Right. Who is Krishna
today?
Because I
have one teacher of mine will say, our ideas about God are not the same as God, right? We may think Krishna is this, and it's an idea we have. Or even if you have an experience of Krishna, the next moment you are ready for a new experience of Krishna.
Right. And Krishna is always changing and different.
Yeah.
Because he's, by definition, he's eternal and he's...
ever fresh, ever new.
Ever fresh, ever fresh.
Yeah. This teacher told me once, our last experience of God is usually the greatest obstacle to our next experience. Because we may get stuck in that, and Krishna's already somewhere else, no, upgraded, ready for a new experience. And if we become too attached, you were this, he's somewhere else now.
And that's the beauty of Radha and Krishna, that Radha's churning, Krishna's love, and Krishna's evolving, ever new leelas showing, and ever new pastimes. And Radha's love is ever deepening because the spiritual world is not bound by the structures of matter. And so Krishna has to evolve to be able to experience the new level of love that Radha is expressing.
And that's the only idea of eternity that makes sense to me, one that is new and exciting, because if everything is already said and done, it sounds more like hell than like heaven, basically.
Right, exactly. You know, stuck forever in
That's why I love what you say, that the best stories are those who are, even if you finish the book, you feel this sense that they are continuing to unfold.
Right.
And for me, it's like that. We have the Srimad Bhagavat in our tradition, and there is the official end to the book. But then comes the Goswami's wrote, Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Lagu Bhagavatamrita, Chaitanya Bhagavat, so many other Bhagavats to say.
Beautiful.
The story goes on, right? So
these are invitations for us into eternity, into that eternity.
And we are reaching the quote-unquote end of the conversation, though it's an ongoing eternal one.
Yes.
But if you allow me, Guru Vani, I'd like to conclude with a little online social experiment that I like to do with my guests. And I know you're courageous and you fastened your seatbelt and you're ready for it.
I'm a fool that rushes in where angels fear to tread.
I would say you are a courageous explorer and curious adventurer, and that qualifies you for this section, which is, I'll offer you 10 short questions, very short, and for each one, I invite you to reply with a similarly short phrase, even one word it could be, or a few words.
Sure.
Related to what the question steers in you, reveals, awakens in you at this precise moment. It's very much in the here and now.
In the here and now.
Okay. Number one, we have 10. Brace yourself. Number one. Do you believe music can save someone?
Absolutely.
What still surprises you about yourself?
How imperfect I am.
Where do you feel most unguarded?
In music, when making music, in that space of creativity.
What are you currently unlearning?
I am unlearning things related to my health and my relationship with my body, my relationship with food. I'm currently in the process of unlearning those things related to how this body has appeared.
Okay. Next one. Is suffering necessary for authenticity?
Unfortunately, yes.
What feels newly fragile for you at this moment?
My relationships with old friends have been evolving in the midst of this last year of health difficulties, both in good and difficult ways. My expectations have been challenged, and my own perception of what friendship is has been also in under excavation.
So in contrast with what feels fragile, what feels indestructible?
The awareness of the soul, the relationship between the soul and the source, the sun ray and the sun, the spark and the fire, knowing that my own identity is inextricably linked with source of consciousness, helps me feel that there is a friendship, even though material friendships may struggle, that there is a friendship at the heart of all existence that is eternal.
Can you have to do a song about that one, just in case? When do you stand before?
Well, there's a beautiful song. There's a beautiful song by Carol King, "You've Got a Friend."
Oh, yeah.
It's a lovely. Beautiful. I do sing that sometimes. Yeah. It's a lovely
beautiful
song.
Beautiful.
Maybe she said it better than I would say it.
It's ever evolving.
You just call out my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running to see you again. Mm. You've got a friend.
Thanks for the reminder. We always need it.
Yes.
Three more, and we conclude. When you stand before an audience, Gurubani, do you feel like you are giving something, or more precisely, like channeling something? Or both? And some...
I feel that I'm channeling. I have had this experience now numerous times where I stand in front of any small or large audience and I feel that a tsunami is coming through me that is not mine and that I didn't create and that I don't control. And in that sense, it's very, very frustrating when I'm not able to do that service, because it just feels so natural and dharmic, and that it's what I'm meant to be doing. And I spend 98% of the rest of my time not doing that, you know. And somehow or other, when Krishna allows me, it becomes so clear that that's a gift.
Wow.
And that I'm receiving and I'm channeling. I'm not really giving. I'm just a messenger who gets to be present to witness.
Mm. Yeah. What are you becoming more honest about recently?
my iniquities, my failings, my faults are becoming more apparent to me, and the need to be my best self doesn't encapsulate it, to try and be whole, to talk about the word that we were using earlier, and to really be fully myself and also striving to be my best self in the midst of all of my faults and mm-hmm. failings.
The last one, when everything falls away, what remains?
Humor.
Madhumangal ki jai.
Yes, I have found. So there's has anyone ever cursed on your podcast, Maharaj, before? Anyone ever said that?
You will have the privilege to be the first one, so feel totally free.
So, oh Lord.
Maybe someone did. It's totally fine. No censorship. Again, we say Gauravani uncensored, so, and Swami Padmanabha uncensoring. So I cannot censor you. You
can beep it out, but there's a... There's a song by Bob Marley, "Thank You, Lord," and it's an older song. It's one of my favorite songs. Mm. It's from his youth. "Thank you, Lord, for what you've done for me. Thank you, Lord, for what you're doing now. Thank you, Lord, for every little thing. Thank you, Lord, because you make me sing." And it's this lovely, it's kind of ska, upbeat, simple song. And I was so down in the dumps last year, November, early December, that I was singing this song, but I was replacing the word thank you with the word fuck you. But through the process of Bob Marley's kirtan, because this is what it is, it's his kirtan to express, you know, they don't have mantra. They have their own mantra. They have English mantra.
Yeah, but there is
know?
Channeling, clearly. There.
It's kirtan without a doubt, you know. So by singing it over and over and over again, not F you, but thank you, by singing it, it became alive. And now when I sing that song, I feel filled with gratitude and joy and presence of the Lord.
Yeah. And sometimes before getting to the thank you, we may need to invoke the F word or go through whatever emotions and messiness and conflict we have. And Krishna is so generous that he allows that form of addressing.
But the humor of it is why I brought it up, because I knew that there was a humorous element. I didn't actually say that word, but I was like, you know, thank you, Lord, for, you know, thanks, God. You know, thank you, you know, and then.
Urabhan, Jeff, we put our sharing to rest only, because again, this is an ever ongoing, ever evolving conversation. Any concluding words, thoughts, something you may want to leave our audience with?
Well, I want to leave with a question for you, that maybe I can ask you a question.
And I don't know if I will answer. We may leave the question there and make a question.
Anywhere on a spectrum. Are you filled with hope for the present and the future? Are you feeling filled with anxiousness for the present and the future? Or are you somewhere in between?
One question in regards to the question, present of the future of my own life, the Gaudiya Vaishnava community, the world as a totality, everything.
In totality.
Okay. Yeah, I will say, of course, there is always anxiousness and doubts and things in some degree, but yeah, hope is always, at the end of the day, is at the foundation of everything. And no matter how much suffering and pain and trauma and betrayal and crisis we may go through as individuals, as a community, as a world community, as you say, love is at the foundation of everything, and it's filling in the gaps, and it's keeping the whole thing together, holding space for all the other things that create anxiety in us. So yeah, I go through both, but by mercy, by grace, the bottom level, the foundation is one of hope. And that's what keeps me going. If not, it's a dead end and it's game over. So yeah.
Thank you.
And thank you for your presence and bringing so much hope with your presence and the gifts of your heart.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.